I'm the co-producer of Bookworm, Sean Sullivan, and I was asked to share one of my favorite Bookworm programs from the archives at kcrw.com. Featuring the old theme song and taped at Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City, 2008, the topic is one of my favorite kinds of books, with a narrative shaped like a person. In Senselessness, the protagonist reads about a nation's atrocities and experiences psychological frustrations. Structured by his mental landscape, a complicated mind finds a full shape in literary possibilities. It's Bad Days Well Written, and Americans today are likely to relate to the atrocities described in Moya's book.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I'm here in New York City attending the Penn World Festival of International Voices, and I'm very pleased to have as my guest today Horacio Castellanos Moya. His novel, Senselessness, is the first novel of his to be published in English. His publisher is New Directions. I'm very pleased as well to be talking to the author of a book published by New Directions, because from their inception to the present, they have always been a publisher where you can trust their books. They published the first things in English of Sebald. They published the first things in English of Roberto Bolaño. And this wonderful, it's a legacy. It goes all the way back to Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams. This is a true American publisher of an avant-garde, and they have never wavered. So you're very lucky, Horacio, to have a publisher of this sort to bring your book into English. I wanted to ask you, it's very hard to define the tone here of Senselessness because it is both satirical and anguished at the same time. Can you describe it?
Well, I think that has both the satirical tone and the anguish tone, but this book, above all, is on mental processes, right? This book is, above all, in this on this process of getting paranoid in a way, right? Getting paranoid because of reading on violence, not because of being witness of violence. And so, the mentality of this character is, I don't know, it has some components of humor in order to, I think, that to resist what he's reading, and has this component of being afraid, being scared, being like persecuted, right?
I think also that the narrator is a moral man. He's in exile from his country, but morality has become complicated because he's said, as a journalist, that his country has had its first African president. What it's assumed he meant was something racist. What he meant, in fact, was that it had its first dictator, its first inflexibly violent ruler. And now that he is in exile, we see that morality, he's very moved. He's doing work. He's reading the gathered and unearthed confessions of people who've witnessed massacres and mass killings. He's writing down sentences that move him. And he's very influenced. As you say, he grows paranoiacal. But at the same time, we discover that, like most people, he's human, and he is a womanizer, perhaps a sex addict, and an alcoholic. And that question of what is it to be a moral human being and be beset by other frailties at the same time, is at the center of this narrator's spirit. Yes,
I agree with you. I think that's the point. I mean, it's not just white or black. I mean, this is a very complicated mentality, a very complicated human being. I mean, this fiction character, of course, and he's like having all this contradiction inside himself. He's just like, on one side, he knows what he's doing. He knows what he's working on, right? And he's aware of that. But at the same time, he doesn't want to be so much aware, because if he gets completely aware, perhaps he will try to escape, not to do that work, to quit that job, because that job is a little bit dangerous. So he's, at the same time that he knows, he's lying to himself in a way. And at the same time that he's working with these very delicate pieces of information, he likes to live, to have a very, in a way, a happy life through, as you said, try to have a kind of intense sexual life and having drinks just to get rid of all this anguish that he has.
He has 1,100 pages to copy edit. They have been variously refined already. The witnesses have been interviewed by a perhaps two expert psychologists. The interviews have been transcribed and made grammatical. His job is to make sure that they're utterly accessible. But one suspects as well that his friend Eric, knowing that our narrator is in exile, has gotten this job for him as a kind of concern, a kind of charity. And of course, in this world, no good deed will go unpunished. And so pretty soon, Eric is the target of the speaker's spleen. Oh, he said there would only be 500 pages. There are 1,100 pages. Oh, he didn't mention that I would be working for the Catholic Church. Well, this is another story. I am a devout atheist. And so before long, he has, being a contrarian, he has reasoned his way into a form of hostility and anguish as soon as he arrives in this office. It's a small, high-ceilinged white room. It has a crucifix hanging. Oh, please, can I take the crucifix down? No, he's told. It belongs to the archbishop. This is the archbishop's unused office that you're in. And so we're watching someone who, under the supervision of Christ on the cross, is going to be reading endlessly about human martyrdom, trying to harden his heart, and at the same time being absolutely destroyed by what he reads. He's a man who likes his pleasures, but all of these terrible testimonies that he's reading about torture and murder in South America are making him aware that his pleasures are absolute necessities to him. He has to escape the horrors that he is reading about in order to drink and to womanize. And it turns out, in fact, that he's in rather special circumstances. All of the women and men who work there are aware that to be handling this material, it's like being infected. They're living in the solemn awareness that they're about to reveal to the world the crimes of a government that tortures and has virtually exterminated indigenous populations, and that he is the vehicle, and he's terrified that he'll be killed by the military intelligence, because everyone, in fact, knows that these documents exist and are on the verge of publication, yes?
That's it. At the same time, he thinks that he's not getting involved, but he's getting involved in all this stuff, and he's getting affected by what he's reading. And one of the points here is that his psychic apparatus is like having all these movements inside. He's perceiving reality in a different way after reading these testimonies. I have this idea that he's getting a little bit mad, like El Quijote got mad reading this chivalry novel, right? Mm-hmm. He's getting a little bit mad because all these testimonies that are terrible. But the fact is that in the book in itself, I mean, like the story that the book has, there is no direct violence. Everything is through his reading, right?
Yes, and I would say that there's a tradition of this kind of narrative. I think that in France, it's called a récit. The first-person narration of someone who is intense and whose sanity may in fact be in question. I think Camus does it in The Fall. But it's by no means limited to French literature. It's there in the stories of Edgar Allan Poe. It's there in Nabokov's Lolita. It's there in many of the novels of Thomas Bernhardt, who was, in a certain sense, your literary mentor, yes?
In a way.
Tell me about Bernhardt.
I have two or three novels that are very deeply influenced by Bernhardt, right?
Bernhardt wrote many novels. He was, in a sense, the enemy of his people. He was an Austrian playwright and novelist. I think his great influence was the prose of Samuel Beckett, the trilogy. And at first, when I first started reading Bernhardt, I said, how can he be doing this? It's so transparently Beckett. But over the years, you watched while imitation developed a great originality.
Yeah.
And the works became more and more interesting, and he became more and more rabidly furious against Viennese culture and announced that his plays could not be performed in Vienna. He wouldn't allow it during his lifetime. His novels were very great. In fact, in the last 40 years, I know of very few prose writers who were not influenced by the rhythms and the hilarity, the hilarious obsessionalism of Bernhardt.
I think that the fact that Bernhardt studied music, he wanted to be a musician and then he wanted to be an actor, but the fact that he wanted to be a musician is very important because I see in his prose, I see this like the art of fugue, right? It's music, it's pure music. But this music is not empty, it's music full of poison, full of very, very strong force, right? And so I think that many, many writers around the world are influenced by Bernhardt. He's a turning point in some ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. And not only that, he composes very distinctly in units. And in the book Senselessness by my guest, Horacio Castellanos Moya, published by New Directions, you see immediately the Bernhardt influence in that the chapters are composed in long paragraphs. Most of the chapters are composed in two long paragraphs, and the fugue state is the mental state of the Bernhardt hero. And this is a man who is, as he is being exposed to the literature that he's copy editing, the literature of testimony, the literature of witness, interview after interview about human depravity, he is going mad.
There is a big difference, too. In my book, as you said before, there are some intense sexual scenes, right? And Bernhard, you don't find that in Bernhard's work, right? You know, it's like, that's the cultural stuff, right? We in Central America, we are tropicals, right? I mean, okay, that sounds a little bit stupid, but it's like that, right? It's like sexuality is around all the time. It's like very intense. And in my work, that situation is represented and the character is affected by all that situation. And he's like a guy that is thinking on sex a lot, right?
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Horacio Castellanos Moya, author of Senselessness, published by New Directions. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Today's Bookworm Show is a rebroadcast of an October 2008 conversation at Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Horacio Castellanos Moya about his novel Senselessness. By the way, it's an extraordinarily good translation by Catherine Silver, and, you know, it's a very good way to find your way into this writing because she seems quite precise as she is translating the tracking of a man who's going a bit mad, who's talking about his past in the same sentence as he talks about his future. And she's rendered the grammatical transformations of perfect tenses. It's a very beautiful negotiation she manages into English of tenses that do not exist exactly in English but do exist in Spanish.
Yeah, it was a challenge in the translation, you know. We talk a lot about that with Katie when she was working. She was doing the first manuscript of the translation, and she did a very good job because it was not easy, because this guy, sometimes when he's getting anxious because what he's reading, even in Spanish, the way the sentences are written are very weird, right? Because he's affected. And he's taking the style of the testimonies, and the testimonies are testimonies that come from indigenous people that do not speak Spanish very well. So the order inside the sentence, the order of the words are the order is different than the normal one. And so to convey that into English was a big, big, big challenge.
But he's being affected by the ability that language has when it's spoken by people who are not proficient, yes? But it's being transcribed. And transcribed, it has to him the aspect of poetry. And one of the ways that he attempts at first to distance himself from what these witnesses who have watched the extermination of entire families, of their entire families, who are speaking about the persistence in dreams of the lives that they've witnessed quashed. First, our narrator wants to celebrate the literary beauty of the language because it's easier to appreciate literature than to endure reports of torture and terror. And this is, in part, one of the devilishnesses of this book, that we're watching someone attempting to have a literary response to the horrible, to the terrible.
It's like to get beauty from pain, right? In a way, it's like... He prefers to do that he prefers to think on all this beauty of the language that the indigenous people have instead of talking about politics. I don't know if you notice that there is no political talk in the book.
Right.
He doesn't talk, he doesn't think on politics. And he's doing something that is very political.
Yes, exactly. And in America, it's not uncommon as well for writers to need to be reminded that the impulse toward pure poetry and the impulse toward political action are not separate things. There's the desire for writers to escape into aesthetic appreciation as opposed to recognizing that language has an effect on the world and to step up to that effect. In your own work, you know, this is a matter for, I call it anguish, you might say paradox, really. The paradox between the beauty of language and the terror of the life it reports. But how do you feel? What do you feel an artist's role should be, if there is a should?
Well, perhaps there is not a should. I think that for me it's very difficult to talk about this topic because there are a lot of common ideas about that, right? I think that
Clichés.
Let's say that if an artist wants to go into politics or wants to play a role into politics or in his society's politics, well, that's his decision, right? That's not a role for all the artists or for all the writers. And that doesn't mean that he's going to be a good writer or a good artist, right? In that sense, there are two different ways of measuring that. I mean, how you develop your own profession. I think that literature affects reality, but in a very indirect way, you know. For me, let me explain, for instance, this. This character, he's enjoying language. But this language that he's enjoying this way of talking of these people, and he thinks this is poetry, right? But these people, they are saying that they are giving their testimonies in order to get better, mm-hmm. in order to get rid of all that pain that they had, all those heavy experiences they had.
It's right? An exorcism.
It's an exorcism, of course. But that fact, they are getting better. For the narrator, becomes a bad stuff because he's getting mad. You know,
he's getting sicker.
Sicker and sicker and sicker. So everything is very relative. So what is good for you is bad for me.
Yes, and that's what I wanted to find a phrasing for, that your work, and I would say the interesting work of our time, is not about deciding this question, but about returning it to its complexity, to dramatize the unanswerability, the lack of finality in trying to make a decision between literature or politics, or between language and pain. Yes, of course, much of the testimony work that has been done in our time, alas, to so much brutality, much of this work is very beautiful. But when you begin to collect it and appreciate it for its beauty, you are becoming a rather grotesque relisher of global iniquity.
Yeah, and that's true. And that's why it's not easy just to judge this kind of situation or this type of character, right? Because he's like very complex. You know, he's like someone full of contradictions, completely full of contradictions, right? And I think that human being is like that.
Yes.
Yeah, we are like that. I mean, we are just all the time talking with ourselves and saying contradictory things. You know, It doesn't matter if we recognize that or if we accept that or if we don't accept that, but that happens inside our mind. Our mind is very, very complicated over time.
Is that the senselessness of the title?
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are many senselessness. You know, was a senselessness to accept that job? Was a senselessness the massacres? There are many levels of senselessness. Perhaps it was a senselessness to write the book.
Well, but it's encased from its very beginning. Its dedication says to SD, who made me promise I would never dedicate this book to her.
Yeah.
So the first violation occurs in the dedication.
That's it.
Then the very next page, we find a quote from Sophocles' Antigone, which is the great interrogation of justice versus personal, the plea for personal pity. And Ismene, Antigone's sister, is saying, "My lord, the good sense one has by birth never abides with the unfortunate, but goes astray." Now, who among us is not unfortunate? So the good sense which we are born with leaves the minute we experience misfortune.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, this. And the more we suffer, perhaps we learn a lot about life, but we are losing a different sense of life too, right?
I've been speaking with Horacio Castellanos Moya, author most recently of Senselessness, the first of his novels in English to be translated, and it is published by New Directions. Thank you, Horacio.
Thank you, Michael.
Me. You can visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, and all podcast services, really. You can even listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Extra special thanks to New York contributor Alan Felsenthal and, here at Carnegie Hall, Leszek Wojcik. Our regular special thanks go to co-producer Sean Sullivan, associate producer Alan Howard, engineer Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
He's a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Britt Bennett is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.